I'm Daniel Chacon. Today, my guest is Estella Gonzalez, author of the phenomenon of a collection of short stories called Chola Salvation. I first saw this book when I walked into the literary bookshop right here in El Paso. In the shop, there's this long table that occupies much of the middle place. And it has books that Bill Clark truly believes in and promotes. And I saw Estella's book on that table. If you could see the cover, it's an image of La Virgen de Guadalupe with makeup and tattoos like a chola. Oh, and long earrings. But the color scheme is the same as most Mexican paintings of La Virgen, the same aura, the shawl with the stars. And if sure enough, in the title story, La Virgen, as well as Frida Kahlo, who is another fundamentally important Latinx feminist icon, they're both depicted as badass, hardcore cholas from the barrio. The story begins in East LA, where Estella is from, and ends up right here in Ciudad Juarez at a tattoo shop. It's funny, disturbing, and ultimately a beautifully assertive vision of what is possible for young Latinx women. Chola Salvation is Estella's first book, and I am thrilled to share this conversation with you.
Words on a wire.
Words on a wire.
Let me read a little bit about your bio. I just have a short one. Estella Gonzalez, her webpage is East Los Writer, because she's from East Los Angeles, and most of her stories are set there. And today we're going to talk about Chola Salvation. The title story in this book, which kind of tells what would happen if Frida Kahlo and La Virgen de Guadalupe walked into an cafe in East LA and met a young waitress, won the Pino Community College Martindale Literary Prize, Pima Community College Martindale Literary Prize. You have a bachelor's degree in English from Northwestern and an MFA from Cornell. And you have been anthologized and published stories all over. So welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's such a privilege to be invited. So exciting.
Are you still in East Los Angeles?
No, I'm not. I'm in Tucson, actually.
Okay.
So, which is beautiful, too. I love the desert. And my husband is here. So I'm here.
And is Tucson giving you the writing space energy? Are you doing?
Oh yeah, this is where I wrote most of my stories before I left for Cornell. This is where I really started to dig into creative writing. I actually took writing courses at Pima Community College, and they had, you know, wonderful creative writing program. It's not as strong, I think, as it used to be, but it was amazing back then. Well, I haven't been there, you know, so what do I know? But it was just, it's just an amazing community, very supportive, very, they were just so much opportunity. The head of the English department there, she actually had she started the Pima writing workshop, and there we saw amazing writers come in to read for us, and we had little workshops there. I took her classes in short fiction. So yeah, that's where I really started to hone the writing, because I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I never thought I could be, because I come from a working class family. You know, writing is for the rich people.
Right.
That's what my mom says, like, writing's for rich people. You can't just sit around and, you know, write. And, you know, I didn't have my own room. I had to share my room with my sister. So I think here, you know, is where I got that supportive community. And I finally allowed myself, you know, to say, hey, I can write. I can be a writer. I've always wanted to do this. Let's start doing it. Let's get serious.
Yeah. Sometimes for writers, especially underrepresented writers, one of the most difficult challenges is to be able to say, I'm a writer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to believe that you're a writer. And then, of course, you write.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, there's the work too. You know, you could say it all you want, but if you're not writing, you know, you know what? Even though still, you know, sometimes we do have to, maybe this is my excuse for me, but it's like sometimes, you know, I just got to read and take a break and, you know, just, you know, restore myself to writing. Because sometimes I do that too. It's like it'll be months before I come back to a story or, you know, right now. You know, I've been working on my novel, you know, I'm almost done with it, but it's taken me years, you know, to finish it, but it's okay. You know, it'll get there. I mean, it took me like about 20 years to get, you know, Chola Salvation, you know, together. And part of it was fear too. You know, I was just afraid to send and to get rejected. I think that's one of the worst fears I had. I know some other writers may have that fear too, but that's part of being a writer too. You're going to get rejected.
That is one of the toughest things to handle. And I think what used to happen in my generation of MFA graduates is that a lot of writers who would get rejected would after a while just quit. And it was the ones that were persistent that ended up getting published. I mean, always you get the ones who are, you know, they had, you know, magical dust, you know, on their fingertips and get published their first book and, you know, and it's great. But a lot of the writers who are just persistent, but now it's a little bit different, I think, because now I don't think you need to be too persistent to publish because there's so much self-publishing and there's so much. There's so many places to publish, not the very thin choices that we had when we were young writers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a beauty to that, too. It's like there's so much opportunity now. Absolutely. And you don't have to feel like.
Right.
Discouraged. I mean, of course, there's still, you know, people who put more stock in, you know, it's like, well, you know, if you don't get published by the big five, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I never that, you know, once I got a taste of the literary establishment, I'm like, you know what, I want to go to a place where they actually respect, you know, Latino writers and, you know, the writers that I love, like Sandra Cisneros, Elena Maria Viramontes. They were published by Arte Público first, you know, and I'm like, you know what? But I was so afraid too. I think I mentioned this in an interview. It's like, if they reject my manuscript, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll be so devastated. They didn't. So that was great.
That was the first publisher I ever submitted to was Arte Publica. And, they also did some of my recent books and I've always appreciated that. They do. They're doing a great service for, you know, the literary culture. When did you leave East Los Angeles?
I left back in 1986 when I went to college, when I went to Chicago.
Can you talk a little bit about the initial difference? We kind of touched on this earlier, but the initial difference between, you know, what you experienced every day growing up in East LA and then suddenly going to, where is Northwestern? Is that in?
It's in the suburb north of Chicago, Evanston.
So those differences, how did they strike you at the time, that juxtaposition of lives?
Oh, it was very interesting. It was like going into another planet, basically. Because, you know, the wealth, you know, it was just, you know, very much, I was like the only, you know, Chicana Mexican person. It seemed like that to me, who was there on the campus, except for, you know, the custodial staff or the people who worked the kitchens. Saw plenty of Mexicans there, but not in the classroom so much. Or even, I don't think I had a faculty of color, except for one. He was an English professor. He was African-American. Wow. I think that was the only professor of color. This was back in the 80s, right? So it was just astonishing to me. Although, you know what, in high school, I think most, if not all of my high school teachers were white, but the student body was mostly, you know, Chicano, Mexican. So, you know, my ethnicity or background that was never questioned.
Right.
And suddenly I started getting questions like, what are you? I'm like, I'm American. Like, no, where are you really from? Like, where are your parents from? Or I get comments like, wow, you don't even have an accent.
Right. Yeah.
I'm like, absolutely. You speak English really well.
Hey, as someone from East Los Angeles, I have a question that is just coming up, and I feel like if I don't ask it, I'm going to regret it.
Do it.
You know, do you remember Chico and the Man?
Oh, hell yeah, I remember Chico and the Man.
Right? And that first 30 seconds to a minute where they played the scene theme song and they had these images of East of Los Angeles. How did you feel about that at the time?
Well, you know what? It was just like, it was just interesting to see, because I think I sort of believe that. It's like, oh my God, it's very ugly here, you know? And,
but the images aren't ugly. The images were beautiful. You'd have this little—
I know.
You'd have people playing in the park, and I didn't see really much gang imagery in it. To me, as a Chicano growing up in Northern California at the time when it came out, it gave me pride. That's the only part of the show I liked.
You know, for me, it's interesting because to me, it just didn't seem— I mean, they're beautiful now, but at the time I just thought, oh, you know, I felt like for some reason I knew there was kind of a put down in it. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you know, this is— we're kind of primitive, or it's like, are we that way? And then Chico, later I found out he wasn't even Chicano. He's Puerto Rican.
You know what it was, I think, because I agree the show was incredibly bad and it does not hold up. But that 1.5 minutes or however long it is of the intro, I would imagine was done by Latinx people or people who knew the community, because it was so diverse in terms of the images. And even though some of them may have, you know, if we look in retrospect, say, well, that's a stereotypical image, it showed compassion, mm-hmm. like the old people mm-hmm. in the park, you know, and, you know, it showed a real community. The show didn't.
Yeah, I think that overshadowed those positive for me. And, you know, I think I couldn't really get through that, too, because basically whenever they show East LA on the news or in the movies, it's like the graffiti. It wasn't like the community so much. I mean, this is what they saw. And I actually mentioned Chico and the Man in that last story too.
Right.
You know, yeah. And it was just, those shows were kind of complicated and problematic for me.
Yeah. But like I said, the show was bad.
Yeah.
The show was bad. But when you are completely lacking an identity, a cultural identity in mainstream culture— and I didn't grow up in East Los Angeles. I grew up in Livermore when this came out, and in Fresno. But when you see those images, those are the, you know, that's like, yeah, that's the, you know, it's, it was almost a reinforcement on some strange level. But we're spending way too much time on this. So I was just interested in that, you know, because I love that everything is so rooted in East LA, all these stories. And the title story, Frida Kahlo and the Virgin Maria, but very unique versions of them, walk into this restaurant and confront or meet a young woman. Can you tell us how this story came about? The origins?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it had started off as a story in one of my fiction classes at Pima Community College. And we were supposed to write about, I think, holidays or celebrations. And I thought, well, quinceañera, let me write about the quinceañera. I never had one personally. I was very resistant to it when I was younger, because for me, it was just like, I was not very femme when I was young. And I totally resisted all those because my parents would just impose that on me. They're like, why don't you dress, you know, more feminine? Why don't you put on makeup like your sister does? Why don't you, you know, you're really pretty. Why don't you do this? I just couldn't deal with that crap. Right. So I remember when my mom proposed that idea of like, why don't you have a quinceañera? And I'm like, oh no, I don't want to do that. And I think I was also a little like, I was a little down on myself too. I'm like, nobody's going to come to it anyway. Why would I want to do all that? So anyway, I was remembering that. And it was a completely different story. I think, you know, before I changed it to this version, you know, the protagonist, Isabella, was very much, you know, very pliant, very— she was kind of a soft character. She didn't put much— she was one dimensional, I think. Right. And somebody pointed that out to me. It's like, you know, Isabella just seems pretty flat. You know, she doesn't really have any, you know, she doesn't sound like a teenager.
Was this in a mother workshop somewhere?
Yeah, this was in a workshop.
In Pima or in Cornell?
Yeah, in Pima. This was in Pima. And that resonated with me. And I said, you know what? Yeah. And at the time, I was also reading Las Cartas de Frida Kahlo. And it was, I think that book was super influential too, because it just brought out the voice of Frida Kahlo. And it was so strong. And I thought, you know, I need that voice. I need something, you know, to carry. And so the story just changed. And it's like, what if I make Isabella, you know, resistant to this? You know, why is she resistant to this idea of a quinceañera? What does it represent for her and to her parents? And how does all, you know, like this Catholicism, this Mexican Catholicism play a part in this resistance too? So I sort of twisted it. La Virgen de Guadalupe is such a huge presence, you know, in Mexican culture, and especially for the women, right? For the girls, you know, she's like your first like role model in a sense, right? Yeah, that's outside of your family. It's like, oh, you know, we like the Virgen, you know, muy, you know, calladita, muy, you know, she's very, you know, respectful and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what if I made her tougher? What if I made her like, you know, somebody who just opposes all these patriarchal restrictions that are always
quite frankly, you made her badass.
Yes. Yes. That's what she needed. I think that's what I needed when I was 15 too.
Yeah. I love how she subverts a lot of the stereotypes of La Virgen in the same way that you subvert the stereotypes of East Los Angeles, right? I mean, it's like there's this cultural representation of what she's supposed to mean, but then you really empower her with, I would say, magic. I mean, there's an incredible power in what she, in who she does and how she doesn't rely on patriarchal conventions to get at something that is true, and in a very radical way.
Yes. Yes.
Have you gotten any slack for this? Anyone from the community who has a more conventional view of La Virgen?
No. Even my mom enjoyed it. She read my story. She really loved it.
Well, it's empowering. It really is.
It is. It is. And I think that's what's the appeal, too. It's like that's, you know, because she's talking about saving yourself in a different way, right? And about taking control of your life and taking control of their, you know, in Spanish or Mexican Spanish is the saying, like, you know, el destino manda. Right. It's like, no, you, tú mandas, right? And so that's what I think the Chola is trying to say. And so it's Frida Kahlo. I mean, I was like, at the time, you know, she was just such a huge, you know, she was trending back then in the early aughts, right? With the movie and the book by Jaime Herrera. And, you know, I love her too, because she's a feminist and she was also embracing the indigeneity of Mexico too. Which I, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, because that's something I think that I grew up with too, this idea that being indígena or being la India was very negative. It's like, you don't want to be like los indios because they're poor and they're dirty. You know, that's the stereotype or the prejudicial, you know, ideas that were around when I was growing up. So that was the worst thing you could be.
And then I love the presence of the feminine deity, the indigenous feminine deity, Tonantzin, within the aura of La Virgen, you know, which kind of really allows her image to be radicalized,
right?
Or to, you know, to in the way that, you know, that we can use to make sense of our lives and to create better lives. And that's really what your main character needed, was a better life. Her father was abusing her, sexually abusing her. He was a drunk. You know, her mom was not very supportive. It was a really tough life. Tell us a little bit about her, that character, and where you got her from, or how she appeared on your pages.
Who, the Virgen?
No, the main character, the waitress.
Oh, Isabella?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. No, like I said, she initially started off as very soft, but, you know, again, you know, I think, you know, she suddenly she had a voice, right? When I started rewriting her, I started, you know, getting that voice. And those were the, not just the voices of like Frida Kahlo, but they're the voices I heard in my past when I was growing up. You know, they're the voices of my tías. They're the voices of my grandmother. And, you know, a lot of the women who were strong in the my life. And I'm like, wow, yeah, this is East LA. These are the voices that I heard when I was growing up, and we would go to parties, or we'd go to church, or we'd go to visit the relatives, you know, out in Coachella or in Guadalajara. You know, these women weren't, you know, it's like, look at my family. I just went to a family reunion. You know, they're not like the original Isabella, who was like soft and, you know, didn't speak her mind. It's like, oh, the women in my family, a lot of them are pretty strong and they do speak out, or they crack jokes. I think that's
you have a lot of really strong women in throughout the stories in yeah. many. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Living the lives that they want to live.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. For better or for worse, right? They make their decisions and it's like, this is my decision. I'm going to live it like this.
Yeah. 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 No, Isabel is a great character. And you can see her getting tougher and tougher as she's more and more influenced by the mm-hmm. you know, Frida and La Virgen. And the story shifts from East Los Angeles to Ciudad Juarez. Why Ciudad mm-hmm. Juarez?
I think, because that, I think that was also something I was reading about too, that a lot of, you know, the Chuco influence came out to East LA. Caló, I think, you know, I know there are different theories about where Caló mm-hmm. came from and Pachucos and all that, but I think, you know, a lot of it does come from, you know, El Paso, El Chuco. Right. So I thought that is the natural gravitational pull, I think, that leads her there. And also my mom is from El Paso too. We visited right. several times and we've been to Juarez. Yeah. And I think too, at that time, you know, Juarez was seen, you know, I think what was coming up were all those terrible, you know, femicides.
Right.
And so Juarez, I think, was on my mind a lot. And so it's like, why not? Why not go to Juarez? And, you know, she can find salvation there. You know, she has to get away.
Right.
And Juarez is Mexico. It is, you know, working class. It is, you know, it's where it's at.
And she gets a job at a tattoo parlor working with a tattoo artist, I would say. You know, that word probably is anachronistic. A tattoo studio that her aunt owned. And she becomes really like her, you know, her models, Frida and La Virgen. She becomes badass.
Yes. Yes. And she's an artist, right? Like Frida, right? Because it is an artistry. I mean, I look at these tattoos on here. I'm like, wow. That's beautiful. I mean, I'm so afraid of needles. That's why I won't get my own tattoo.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's artwork.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the other story in this collection, Chola Salvation, that really struck me was Sábado Gigante. And at first, the title struck me because I wrote a story called Sábado Gigante in one of my collections. It doesn't even matter which one. And it made me realize what a zeitgeist for certain generations of Latinx Chicano people, Sábado Gigante was this image of, you know, all day Saturday, you know, all day this variety show.
Yes.
And it was always on and you couldn't escape it. And when I was young, we had to stay at my grandma's sometimes on Saturday and she'd be watching it all day and we hated it. We were little pocho kids who wanted to watch.
Yeah, I know.
Cartoons, you know? But it's such a powerful symbol. So how did this story come about and how did this story become related to a young man, a young Chicano kid growing up in East LA who is gay but has to hide it from his father, which is also, I wonder if that's part of a zeitgeist, because my character in Sábado Gigante was also gay.
You know, interesting. Really,
and like I said, I know this is a zeitgeist, that Sábado Gigante means something to us. So
yes.
Talk about it.
No, and just to mention too, Caribbean Fragosa, whom you also interviewed, she has a story called Sábado Gigante.
It's a zeitgeist.
I think we can't get away from that. Yeah. I'm surprised. One of these days, I'm going to write a story about Edie's Chacon too.
Oh, yes. Yes, Edie's Chacon had a special place in my heart when I was a kid because I was a
I'm sure. My dad watched it consistently.
Yeah, that's amazing. So how did the story come about, and how did it become a story about Gustavo, who is this young gay man who has a degree and gets a decent job, and then falls in love with his boss, it seems.
Yes. Well, yeah, and so that story started off as a prompt. I belong to a writing group. I think that's another thing that I think writers can benefit from, especially writers of color, is just, you know, belonging to writing groups. And we meet each week and we give each other prompts to write from, you know, it could be anything. And I forget, I think we were doing body parts. And so I chose the hands. And so if you notice that story starts off with the hands of his father, right? And so that's how that story started. And then suddenly it started evolving. It's like, wow, who is this man? And, you know, who is the family? You know, is this really a story about Bernardo, or is it going to be about somebody else? And Gustavo came up. And, you know, most of my stories are set in the 80s. Sábado Gigante was big in the 80s. And I think at that time, you know, we also had the AIDS crisis. And I think I was writing this, actually, this must have been before the epidemic. So, but I just was remembering, you know, some of the boys in my high school class who I found out later they were gay. And you know, my mom's like, well, why didn't they come out before? And I'm like, Mom, back in the 80s, a Chicano coming out, he would have been destroyed.
Right.
Yeah. And she's like, well, that's wrong. And I'm like, I know it's wrong, but that's how it was.
Right. And so let me ask you, you know, I love your characters. Isabella, she became so complex. Gustavo becomes complex. Is there a point in the writing process where it's like the character introduces, like it suddenly just shows up and you know who he or she is and on another level than when you started?
Well, you know, it depends. I usually hear a voice, you know, it starts off with the voice of a character and I just start writing and they just develop as the story continues. I mean, you get glimpses of them right away, you know, sometimes, because Gustavo, you know, that scene where he slaps his sister, that came out of nowhere. I'm like, whoa.
And that was a surprise. That was a surprise when I read that, but it was a believable surprise.
Yes. And I'm like, well, that makes sense because he's the only boy. Right. He gets to do what he wants. You know, he's always right. And if Bernardo treats his wife this way and his daughters this way, you know, and why not? You know, he'd probably treat him that way. So, but yeah, that came out. That just came out, you know, boom, boom, boom. I don't know. That's the way it works for me. It's like suddenly, boom.
I think I really believe that's the way it has to work. When you want to get at something good, you know, it just got to come. And the more you learn your craft, of course, the more when you revise, you recognize easier. It's easier to recognize what's going on. And so you can revise according.
Right.
But one of the details in this story I liked is that he falls in love with his boss. So I don't know if it falls in love or he just falls in lust, but he's really enjoying his company. And and they have a great encounter. And this man's name is Tristan, and he thinks about Tristan and Isolde,
right.
You know, which of course is an opera, but a legend, and, you know, has been picked up by many, many different writers and artists throughout, you know, generations. Why did you choose that? And what does it mean to you in terms of the story?
Yeah, no, that was also one of my influences with the Arthurian legends, you know, Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur. And then at Northwestern, I took a class in medieval literature, which I still have the romance of Tristan. And for me, for some reason, I just thought it was the most beautiful love story ever, better than Guinevere and Lancelot. I mean, again, this was adultery going
right.
I just thought it was just so, like, you know, this hopeless love, you know, that can never really be consummated, or it was consummated actually, but it could never like last.
Right.
And so, you know, I thought for Gustavo, you know, he's a romantic too, I think deep down, because for him, it's harder. He can't really exercise or, you know, consummate his own desire for men or, you know, his relationships.
Yeah, his dad literally told him, if you ever become gay, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah. And so it's a life or death, literally life or death for him. So, you know, when he can actually express or feel that love, lust, your romanticism, you know, it's amazing. It's like, wow, you know,
right.
You know, and the boss returns it. That's even better. So it's a what do you call that kind of love? It's not when it's not returned. It's called, what is it called? Unrequited. This is requited love for him, right? And you know, whether it's love or whether it's last for you know a long time, it doesn't matter. At that moment, somebody does return his affection, right. His attraction. And it's amazing. Yeah. You know, I just want to go back to those first moments, you know, when you first fall in love with somebody or when right. somebody actually likes you and you like them. It's like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Oh, and that waiting for the phone call or, you know, when the phone rings, he knows it's him. And it's like, ah, God, I forgot what that was like. Even having a phone on the wall that somebody else could come for.
There's nothing like it. It's like, oh my God, is it him? Is it him? You know, it's like, I know what that feels like. So, you know, I purposely named his boss Tristan. So
right,
and I've always liked that name too.
Yeah, it is a cool name. And actually, you know, when I heard the name, I immediately saw him, which was really kind of cool because the name just gave me an image, right? Mm-hmm. But the other thing about this is he's got this father Bernardo who basically said he would kill him if he's gay. Who spends the weekends partying in the garage, listening to old Mexican music, you know, the rancheros and stuff, as they're drinking until he gets so drunk, they have to pull him into the house and put him to bed. And the very last image is the sound of his father out in that garage. And it's very powerful because it almost, you know, indicates that he's still trapped within that world, but at least he had his forbidden moment. And so it's a really beautiful
moment. And maybe he'll get out of it too. I mean, because he's on the verge, you know, he has a job and
that's the thing. You as the writer, you don't need to tell us that because we'll decide on our own. And if you're invested in the character like I am, I know he's going to get out of it. This is just the beginning for him. Yeah, absolutely. He can't live in that oppressive situation forever. He needs to be like Isabella and go to see that Juarez and become badass.
Right.
Metaphorically speaking.
Just go to West Hollywood. Just go to West Hollywood and be badass there.
Metaphorically speaking, of course. Yeah. So how long did it take you to write this book, Chola Salvation?
It took me about 20 years.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you could say that before. Yeah. Which makes sense to me. And then the novel that you're working on, how long do you think that's going to take from the moment you start it to the moment you're ready to send it?
Oh my goodness. I started that novel back in grad school.
Wow.
So I graduated in 2009. So it's already taken 12 years to get it done.
Yeah. Well, that's good because you're getting it right. And that's what matters.
I think so. I mean, I'm a slow writer. I think Elena, she mentioned that she's a slow writer too. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just like you. I'm a little tortuguita, you know, just trying. And maybe that's, you know, it could be a blessing and a curse because it just takes so long. And maybe it shouldn't be that way. It's like, you know what? I just got to get it out and just, you know, and there it is. And then I'm also trying to work on other stories too. Right. So, I think it's just that fear in my head. It's like, I don't want somebody to come at me saying, you know, this is wrong or this sounds stupid or this sounds repetitive or, you know, but, you know, I guess that's how we are as writers, right? We want to get it right. Cause you know, you read other people's work and I'm like, I want my writing to be like Elena's. I want my writing to be like Jane Austen's or, you're your own original writer too, but you know, when I reread them, I'm like, oh, this is so beautiful.
that moment when you read something so amazing, you think, why am I even trying it?
I know.
I believe that energy that goes into feeling that way, why am I even trying it when this is so brilliant, is also the same energy that feeds you when you read something so brilliant and you say, hey, I thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
Something I wanted to feed. Do, you know? Yeah,
this is why we read too. I was a voracious reader when I was younger. And, you know, I'm still, you know, I just ordered a new bookshelf because I'm like, I got more books. Yeah. I got to put them somewhere. And, you know, that was also one of my dreams too, was to have a library. When I was a little girl, you know, we had a little teeny bookshelf and, I'd start putting books in there. And, you know, that was my big dream. It's like, one day I'm going to have a room, you know, I'm going to have my own library. Yeah, that was my big dream.
on Instagram, I follow this this group. I forget the name of it, that just posts photos of libraries and, you know, home libraries, you know, ancient libraries, just all these different books. And it's just, to me, it's very beautiful. And yeah, just to have a portion of that in our own home is awesome.
Yeah, and a shout out to the libraries, because that's where I spent a lot of my time when I was younger, too. There was a local, the East LA Library, after school, when I was in junior high school, I'd go there every day after school and just, you know, I'd do my homework, but I'd also just linger around the stacks just to see what books they had, you know.
Have you ever done a reading there? Now that this is out, will you do a reading there?
I would love to do a reading there. And I've contacted the librarians. It was still COVID times when I contacted them. Yeah. So I'm hoping now that they're opening up, you know.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be great to do it there. And have you done any events in East LA since the book has come out?
No. No, I haven't. You know, it's just been, you know, they've been slowly opening up. I've done mainly online events.
Right.
So that's
relegated. That's just the reality of today. Yeah. The physical needs are becoming less and less.
But I would love to. Anybody listening to this, I would love to come out to East LA and do a reading.
Well, I'm sure that there will be multiple opportunities in the future. On your webpage, what is your webpage address? It's East. What is it again? Your webpage.
Here, I'll check it out. It's whoops.
Well, anyway, on your webpage, you say that you are. It says fiction writer, and then in parentheses, sometimes a poet. Can you explain that?
Oh, I've published poetry too. I'm still working on it, but I have had a few poems published. I published one in Nasty Women Poets, an unapologetic anthology of subversive verse. I just got published in another anthology, The Things We Leave Behind, and that was published by the Ice Colony. Mm-hmm. Puerto del Sol, a long time ago, I published a poem called How to Talk to Your Mother. So I do love writing. I love the poets too. You know, they inspire me too. And the beauty of poetry is that they have to say so much with a few words. Absolutely. And so, you know, if you want to be a writer too, my recommendation is read a lot of poetry. Ayana Delgado is another. Felicia Zamora. I mean, there's so many.
Yeah.
And you guys interviewed Felicia Zamora.
She's great. She's on the level of mystical. She's a fantastic.
Yes. Oh, she's so great. She came out to Tucson for the book festival. So she was Eduardo Corral. Oh my God. Guillotine. Have you read that book?
Oh yeah. He's amazing as well.
So beautiful.
Well, your webpage is eastloswriter.com. Check it out. And the book is called Chola Salvation. It's a collection of stories by Estela Gonzalez. Estela, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. This was so fun. This was so much fun.
I'd like to thank Estela Gonzalez for joining me on Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon. Take care of yourself, read lots of books, buy lots of books, and be safe.